And he tries to talk about this in terms of certain models of brain action. I want to proceed by reading a little bit from what he says and commenting myself, and I invite your comments and the questions you may have about the book. I want to point up something that I think is very important, which he makes a good deal of. He is trying to talk about our behavior, and not just individually, but as societies, how we behave as societies, how we interact with our universe. He's trying to do this by talking about the brain. He says, on page 8, early in the book, he says, people are curiously unwilling to accept and use a simple and obvious idea that all the things that they do involve activity in their brain. There is an I in some way distinct from my body. Our brains are so constituted that we have learned to speak always in terms of self and otherness. We use the convention, he calls it, the convention, that placed in some way within us, there is an agent who is said to act as we describe other men acting, the habit of what he calls animism, enables us to speak of the actions of all sorts of things in terms of the actions of people. We do not find it easy to talk without speaking of some entity, the self, communicating with others. It's very difficult for us to think physiologically, to think of what we do and feel and aspire to as somehow representing something going on in the tissue inside the bony brain case. And so if you have difficulty reading this book, this may be one of the reasons you find it hard to think of yourself in that way, as events in tissue, of tissue. And he goes on to talk about the interaction of the brain and the external sources of stimulation or energy with which the brain as an organ, as tissue, as matter, interacts. And because this is an interaction to Jung, there is an effect on the brain of the way that it interacts with the world about it, so that what you think of what you feel so directly and call your ideas, your thinking. And you see, it's almost impossible for you to talk about such a thing without using that pronoun, possessive, as though it's yours. The you, mine, stands for something. Something, I think, for most of us, other than what we would mean when we have described ourselves quite completely. And as he says, we learn to talk about the self and otherness. Now, he says farther on in the book, recently we have learned that it is better not to use this animistic way of speaking about physical things. Perhaps, therefore, we do not even need to do it when talking about ourselves or each other. What Jung then is trying to point up, I think, is the basic problem of the relation of our communicative means, our languages, and our communicative behavior, including our attitudes toward our languages and our ways of understanding our communicative behavior, the relationship between all of this and the other aspects of how we live and the way we organize ourselves in societies. And I would like to try to maintain this discussion on an impersonal, objective, essentially scientific level with regard to this. He is saying to us, in effect, that there are various ways of constructing, of formulating, of thinking about a matter of this kind, this problem of the relationship between our communicative behavior and the other aspects of our behavior and the social world we make. It's hard for us to think of any alternative languages, alternative, that is, to the one that we're accustomed to. If you have happened to read Hayakawa's book for one of your supplementary readings, you will remember that he, I think in that book, develops the contrast between the language we use when we talk about our car. We take our car to the mechanic, as you may remember his describing. And we talk with the mechanic about the car, the engine. Of course, these days, perhaps not very many people who drive cars could talk about the engine, but there are some who can, and so far as they do, they talk a language which tends to make for a rather good communication, because both persons are talking quite obviously about the engine, the spark plugs, what they do, and the cylinders and how they're made, and what goes on in the cylinder, the carburetor, and so forth, ignition. And so they get along very well talking about the engine and the car. But then, as time goes on, they start to talk about the upcoming election or something. What we call politics, or maybe morality, or religion, or education, or something else, in which we use another kind of language. And he develops a contrast between these languages. This is something of what Jung is trying to direct our attention to. The alternative ways of trying to communicate. And it is possible to be experimental about communicative behavior. You can try to talk about yourself or other persons and what they do in the way in which you try to talk about a car. Now, I'm not, in saying this, advocating anything in the way of a mechanistic philosophy versus some other kind. I'm not advocating anything. I'm pointing out that you can make the experiment. You can try to talk, as Jung does, about the behavior of the human being, especially the communicative behavior, as you might talk about a computer. You can do this. The fact of the matter is that when you do these things, you do discover that this is one way to find out about the differences between the computer and the person, for example, or the car and the person. But in any case, what you will probably find out from reading Jung, probably, I say, because I don't know what you will find out. It depends upon what you bring to the book. But I think what you might find out is that no matter what language you use in talking about anything whatever, you are using a language that is metaphorical, that is a model. And this book is distinctive, among other things, for what it has to say, I think, about the model characteristics of our languages. In general, as he points out, we have, for the most part, developed languages for talking about the tools that we have developed. We invent a wheel, a clock, an engine, and we develop a language for talking about it, and then we use that language for talking about ourselves. Not only psychologically, but physiologically, as it were. During the last century, a great deal of the attention of inventors and persons in industry and concerned with technology was centered on the gasoline engine. And engines like that. And so they developed language for talking about engines. Engines consume fuel. And if you were to look in textbooks of physiology, even today, but certainly older ones, you would find that much of what the physiologists were saying about the human body, they were saying with the language that had been developed for talking about the combustion engine. It is the language of fuel, combustion, the converting of food as fuel into energy. Much of physiology is presented, formulated, thought about by using a language designed very largely for talking about engines. Even psychologists have used this language a good deal in talking about personalities as powerful or weak. And much of the common thinking about ourselves and each other has been in terms of the engine kind of language. So when we say that someone has a lot of personality, we mean that somehow he dominates, overpowers others. It is an engine language to a large degree. Now, if you're not using an engine language, you're probably using some other kind of language. You are very seldom, and I think if we had enough time to wonder a great deal exhaustively, we might even conclude that we never, but I wouldn't be ready to use the word never at this moment, refer directly to what we think we are referring to. We're almost always using, I would prefer to say almost always, using a model, a language designed primarily for talking about something else. We even use the language developed for talking about ourselves, this animistic language that Jung talks about, for talking about engines or our tools or for what we call natural things. And so our language is to a large degree to be described as the animistic model. I don't want to take too much time on this. I want to say enough to direct attention to what I think is one of the very important things about this book, is talking about languages as models to a large degree, and the effects that these languages have on the people who use them. You will say different things about yourself if you use the language developed for talking about computers than you will if you use a language developed for talking about animals, or a language developed for talking about clocks or the telephone system. The language of the computer will tend to have the effect of making you give much attention to information and to control of your behavior through a feedback principle. The computer is a machine designed to deal with information, to store it, arrange it, organize it, to make it retrievable, and to analyze it. And the language of the computer used in talking about you or me or any human being, and about human beings as a society, is a language in which information and its role and what we do with it tends to be greatly emphasized. And control comes in for great stress, because the machines developed for automation of industrial processes, for example, are machines in which the feedback principle has been built in order to regulate what the machine does, in order to control a process. The language of the computer would tend to, I think, to encourage an ethics, even, in which the emphasis would be upon what we do with information and what kinds of control, what we try to control and by what means, and who exercises the control. Questions of this kind would become exceedingly important to anyone using the language of the computer or the servo mechanism in talking about persons. I'd like also to call attention to part of the book, which I think is very provocative. I'll try to find it for you. It's the fifth lecture. It starts on page 89. How We Learn to Communicate is the title of the chapter. In this chapter, the author discusses the role of assembly, human assembly, in relation to the development of our brains and our communicative behavior, our society. He calls attention to the rather astonishing fact that we find in many places scattered about the earth artificial hills, the pyramids would be an example. If you go to Mexico City, be sure to go out 25 miles north and see the pyramids. And I hope you'll have plenty of time to stand and stare and wonder what went on here. There's some enormous structures. There's one enormous structure and some others that aren't so big. These are artificial hills, in the sense in which Jung, I assume, is using the term. Evidently, people gathered around these hills. They were cooperative endeavors to begin with. It was perfectly obvious that hundreds of thousands of people had to work together to build such a thing. And this is rather impressive evidence of the cooperativeness of the human creature. And if you look at one of those artificial hills long enough, you begin to wonder, where do we get our competitive behavior? How do you account for it? evidently these hills were assembly places. Every so often, for certain reasons which came to be recognized, the tribesmen gathered. And so the artificial hill became a kind of a means to communication. And at the hill, when the people had gathered, there were certain things done. And so they developed festivals, the acting out of their feelings, and so we had spring festivals and harvest time festivals and so forth. And they also evidently buried the dead in the hills. And so the place became, in this way, somehow different in meaning from other places to the people. It was different. And this may have been, according to Young, one of the ways in which the temple originated. And in each of the temples, he says, they assumed that there was some, not just the bodies of the dead, but a spirit. And so one can speculate, as he does, about the development of the great powerful symbol systems that hold people together in groups that share in common some very, very basic convictions about their natures and their relationship to other nature. I think you'll want to spend some very thoughtful time reading that part of the book. There is a great deal else, and I don't want to try today to presume to cover the book. I want to say enough to engage your attention to it, with it. And I would wish that enough of you have read the book or read at it that you might want to wonder about it out loud yourself and I could work with you. Do you have some things you'd like to say or ask? Do you take this to be an important book, or is this an impractical sort of a book to you, or is it fascinating, or is it dull, or does it puzzle you in any way? Do you see something in it that is tremendously important that you'd like to talk about? I'll be quiet now for a minute. And if you don't feel moved to say anything, that's interesting too. Now, I'd like to ask one of you who does not feel moved to say anything, why don't you? I'll go eeny, meeny, miny, mo unless you beat me to it.
I do feel that we're moved to say something.
Can you talk loudly enough so others can hear?
out of the entire book, perhaps the thing that stands out most in my mind is his discussion of randomness, and the one very important aspect of this, of his discussion that he points out, and how it makes the birth, death more meaningful. It seems that people live longer and make more choices and get a little bit more certainty, but as they do this, they cut out some of their potential randomness. And but this makes the birth and death have another significance. But what I would ask for you to do is tie this in with the other 2 points that you said.
Well, as I get what you're talking about, the he does talk about the entropy. Is this what you're talking about? The problem of order versus randomness, and what is it now that you particularly want to focus on?
Well, it seems to me that this is almost a point apart from the communication idea in the book, and it also seems to me that that shouldn't be a point apart, but I can't, in my own mind, tie them together properly.
You're toward the end of the book, and he's talking about basically another kind of model, as I read it, the statistical model, populations and samplings of populations, and the descriptions of populations, of events, and of whatever you may be wanting to consider. And he's talking about the basic problem of order versus disorder. No? And you want to relate this to communication and to cooperation and to what he is trying to say about the brain in relation to all this. You find this difficult to do?
Well, I find that I haven't been able to do it yet.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean I won't be able to. I expect you to do a far better job than I can.
Well, those of you who wonder what this part of the book is about, I think that you're talking pretty much about what you'll find starting on about page 152 or 3. Well, you may not have my edition. This is the 8th lecture. If you have the paperback edition, it probably isn't page 153. This is a hardback edition. Let me just point it up a bit this way, by reading something. We are getting the habit of speaking more and more about populations with all their variety. The use of this model alters the way we speak about many things, including our own selves. And it provides a new system that unifies many fields of activity, from physics through biology to sociology. In fact, it is not too much to say that it is the basic model for the functioning of modern societies. He's still talking about a way to talk about ourselves and our social organization. This is another model, the statistical model. When you start talking about yourself as a population, you know, you are an army. You are many, many selves. If you're going to talk about yourself, which one? In the old language, you talked about yourself. In the new language, you talk about yourselves. And so you have to think of yourself in a new way. As a population, you can be sampled, and any sampling has some kind of characteristic distribution. You have modal tendencies, and you deviate. And you are some of the important things about you then are the shape of your distribution, as it were. Are you a very consistent kind of a person? Do most of yourselves tend to be about alike? Are you a varied kind of a distribution? How do you relate does a sampling of you relate to a sampling of other, of someone else? You think about marriage in this way, in a new way. In the old language, someone was looking for the only one, other. No sampling here, no population thinking, no probability thinking. But now you think of yourself as a distribution. Suppose you're this way and you marry someone that way. Not a very good matching. How variable are you? How big, so to speak, is your standard deviation as a population? I suppose this is one way to ask something that people think of in terms of order and entropy. How big is, how consistent are you? Consistency can be carried to the point of rigidity. Rigidity can be carried to the point of death. Talking now in terms of the order of a system or the entropy of a system, death becomes a certain kind of state in the system. In general, as I think he says somewhere, that brain will be of the most effectiveness or use to you, or I forget the words he used, which always seeks to make a different pattern. When you cease trying to make new patterns, you become, if you want to think in terms of this model, a different kind of distribution. Now you're peaked, not much variation about you anymore. The creative person is always seeking to make new patterns. He says a great deal. Almost his basic hypothesis about the brain, he says it over and over again, I don't know whether I can put my finger on it anywhere, is that the way the brain reacts to the input is to try to match it to a model that it already has available. But he puts a good deal of emphasis on the fact that what is being matched, the input, is never quite like the model. So you don't have then anything that you could call identity, sameness of the input and the existing model. But so far as you can achieve a first approximation to what you would call understanding, you do it, he says, or the brain does it, by matching the new sensation, the new sensory pattern, against an existing model. But the creative person, you see, is trying all the time to make new models and to operate with a variety of models. And so you can talk about persons being more or less creative in these kinds of terms. You can do it. Why would you do it? Partly because you can, and partly because if you do, you can note what the effects are. Well, over and over again, he talks about the model matching function of the brain. Anybody else want to share in this?
Is this contrary to one of the basic postulates of semantics, in that this is the way the mind works, is through analogy and metaphor. And great semantics can tell us that we should look for differences. Whereas the mind is constantly looking for semantics.
I thought that's what I was saying a moment ago, if you want to make that comparison. The model is never like the input. It is always different. And so when you match them, it is an approximation. And creativity lies, we can say, with this kind of language, in trying to make new models. In being, what the model gives you is a kind of a test for the differences in inputs. It's not the same as any one of them. The inputs differ in a way in which they do not match the model. Now, if you have a variety of models against which to match inputs, you are able to be much more sensitive to their unique, to the unique character of any input.
Maybe I'm missing a point here, but it seems to me if you follow this pattern that cow one is not cow two, is cow n, or follow that through, well, this would destroy the...
No, you still have cow. You still have cow. On any such thing, you have the commonality, and you have the differences represented by the numbers. But so it's a matter of recognizing, a means of trying to symbolize the differences within the similarities. There is no, I don't believe you interpret general semantics properly when you make this into a dichotomy. And either you pay attention to similarities or you pay attention to differences. There is always something there to be different. And sometimes the differences, sometimes the numbers are more important than the words here. Sometimes the words are more important than the numbers. But in general, I think it is a reasonably dependable observation of people in, shall we say, our culture, or we'll talk about us, that we would tend usually to pay more attention to the cow than to the number, than to which cow. We would tend usually to pay more attention to the fact that the person was a Negro than to which Negro. We pay more attention to the fact that the person was a professor than to which one. He's one of those professors. He's one of those teenagers. One of those women drivers. One of those divorcees. One of those capitalists. One of those communists. We don't. Do you suppose those who are concerned with what they call the communist menace are very much interested in which one it is they're talking about. And the same with, you suppose that the ardent New Dealer, Fair Dealer, whatever it is these days, is very much concerned with the differences between two Republicans. So it's a matter of the relative emphasis, but not a dichotomy. Am I talking to the point for you?
But there's still a basic point here that
okay. Yeah. See you Wednesday.